Hey, watch your face. That knife is going to slip, man.
I know. I was very scared.
Come on. I don't need to call 911 over Skype here.
In a world where you only have trailers and posters to judge a movie, Jim and Ted strike out to answer the age-old question, will you see it?
All right. Hey, Ted. It is episode 38. And last week, I don't know what happened. We were at your house and there were some weird echoes in the recording. But hey, we did the best we could for our work.
You did a great job.
Hey, it's our novice recording. You know what I mean?
Right.
But, you know, let's start the week and we're going to kind of get caught in that past to present to past loop.
Yep.
But let's give old Burt Reynolds a little bit of a,
yeah.
You know, a little nod and acknowledge the awesomeness that he was.
A little send off.
Yeah, a little bit. I mean, but you know, this is gonna
let's start with your wall.
With my wall. Oh, Deliverance.
Squeal, squeal.
Yeah, he's in Deliverance.
Why is the wall in your house and I'm the one that remembers it all the time?
Because I see it too much.
It's more novel for me, I guess.
It's one of those things like, don't look at your computer, but which way is the apple facing? Left way or right way? Hey, so which was your favorite Burt Reynolds movie?
It's got to be Boogie Nights.
Boogie Nights.
So you know me. You know my reputation. 13 inches is a tough load. I don't treat you gently.
Boogie Nights. I mean, you know, being on Twitter, people ask you your favorite everything. And a lot of people are spelling with a U. So I guess they're over there, either in Australia or the UK.
Is that like Boogie Nights?
Boogie Nights. Yeah. So Boogie Nights for sure. Burt Reynolds, I think it's a pinnacle of his coolness. You know, he's the director of a hot, hot genre.
Yeah.
You know, before it was... I mean, it was always taboo, the porn industry, but there was a time around that time of Boogie Nights where it really had a cachet. The filmmakers were filmmakers, and he played that director. I think the second for me is probably The Longest Yard.
Oh, yeah, great one.
And I say that as a person who only knows The Longest Yard from clips. I've never seen the whole movie.
Really? Yeah, the last, 20 minutes was him running back and forth trying to score a one-inch touchdown. Well, I guess a one-yard touchdown, but no, for me, I think it's Smokey and the Bandit.
Yeah, no, it's classic.
You know, it was one of those things where, like, it was right in my wheelhouse for the age that I was, and when it came out, and I mean, like, the Trans Am and the trucks and the whole thing. I mean, and then you have Jackie Gleason.
This is Sheriff Buford P. Justice of Texas. I'm in a high-speed pursuit.
Amazing, you know, I mean, so that's one of my favorite Burt Reynolds. I mean, it's kind of corny, you know, and it's kind of just like, I haven't seen it in decades. Probably doesn't even hold up, but for where I was at that time of my life, that's what anchored Burt Reynolds in my head.
Yeah, so Smokey and the Bandit, you might have to take my man card for this, but is that the one with the orangutan?
No, that's... That's Clint Eastwood.
No. What is that? Is that another car movie? Like a car TV show or something?
Yeah, that was Every Which Way But Loose.
Oh, of course.
Yeah, I think his like ex-wife was, I don't remember her name, but the blonde woman in it or something. And there was like a whole, like, as I recall, but there was like a whole, what was it, like five movies around that orangutan. But yeah, Clint Eastwood, you know, as good as, well, you don't like his directing, but as good as a director that I think he is, and just the movies that Clint Eastwood has been in, you know, and just his lore, you know, The Man with No Name, the whole thing about Clint Eastwood. But then he had this like run in the, like, what, 80, like late 70s, early 80s where,
yeah,
I mean, like, what was he, I mean, Dirty Harry's, I mean, like, brilliant. And then you get into these, like, I don't know, like comedic adventure roles that just were just dumb.
Yeah.
Whatever. We're way off touch of what even we want. How did we get here?
Burt Reynolds. And I thought there was a car in this movie. I don't know. I thought there was an orangutan in Smokey and the Bandit, but there's not.
No, wasn't it like a basset hound?
It's your movie.
It's my movie. No, like the main, the trucker that he was buddies with had like a basset. I don't even know, man. It's been like I said, it's been like probably 30 years since I've seen it. But
Rip Burt Reynolds. And there's a Nike ad that released this week called Dream Crazy. That's the name of the full 2 minute piece. It's about 2 minutes. It's kind of, it hinges around Colin Kaepernick, but he's really not very featured in it. You know, it's definitely
until the
his
end.
Until the end.
Right.
But this really goes to a few things that I was talking about. Back when we were on the TiFo podcast, I had mentioned that when you have a voiceover talent, the voiceover talent doesn't carry the baggage with them unless you see their face with their voice.
Agreed.
And for the majority of this, at the top of it, I think it's on purpose that Nike does not show you that it's Colin Kaepernick. And it's a spoiler now, but hopefully everyone has seen this piece of marketing, this advertisement, and whether they're watching Thursday Night Football or any, and it's going to be on all over the NFL. You know, they paid to put it in there. But throughout it, it is Colin Kaepernick, spoiler, but you don't know it until the end. And it doesn't sound like a football player. And he doesn't have the timbre in his voice for a football player. You know, the things that he's saying are very inspirational and they sound intelligent. So I think, you know, there is something to say about the voice not having any bag until the very end. And then when they pull it together, I think it's meant to disjoint you at that point. There was initially a lot of backlash for this advertisement and this campaign. And, you know, there's a lot of online animosity towards these inanimate objects of the shoes, you know, people destroying their shoes and destroying their socks.
Because Colin Kaepernick is like a spokesperson?
Yes, because Colin Kaepernick is a spokesperson for them.
I have things to say about that.
But I'll just wrap up a couple of the points. So the big takeaways from this were, initially, the first day that the ad campaign came out, there was a big hit to their stock. Their stock took a hit, 3% hit, equaling about $4 billion. So that's a huge hit. But in the marketing space, it played really, really well. It gained them about $40+ million in buzz that they generated without spending a single dollar. So that's a huge lift for this marketing campaign. And the sales for the first weekend, this Labor Day weekend, were up 31% as opposed to the same weekend last year, which was up 17%. So there is a positive, these are online sales. So as far as online sales versus overall sales, it's probably, there's a little bit of spin there. But I think there is a positive outcome that Nike can spin out of this whole thing. And that's what I was leaning towards.
Yeah. So Ted, will you clarify just for a second for me? So,
yeah.
You know, you kind of went on a little bit and I lost track of exactly where we were.
Sorry.
But no. I mean, I totally get what you're saying with all that. But the one thing I'm not sure of is, you know, just clarify what you mean by when you say like he doesn't sound like a football player or something, or or like not smart. What did you even say? I don't even remember now.
Well, I'm sure people will remember. So I did say he didn't sound like a football player. And I guess I did either say or allude to the fact that football players don't sound intelligent. But I think that is a ham-handed way of encompassing Colin Kaepernick in a fraternity of which I feel I'm not a professional football player. I never was going to be a professional football player. I wasn't even I was a starting high school football player. So that being said, I feel a fraternity with people that play football. But we do have a air about us that comes off as a jock that is not as intelligent as the rest. Sometimes jocks are just meatheads, you know? And I think that is where they kind of fall into a stereotype.
Yeah. Yeah, I know what you mean.
I was trying to say, didn't sound like a football player, to encompass a non-racial stereotype, because I think that is a more powerful thing to say. And sometimes a little, you know, if someone were to say, oh, it doesn't sound like Colin Kaepernick, or it doesn't sound like the person, then you're making a stereotype and you're being uncertain and unclear about what you're stereotyping. But I feel like if you're stereotyping football players, I think that's a little more acceptable. I don't, it's not right. There's plenty of smart football basketball players. I mean, you know, Fitzpatrick is a Harvard graduate, you know what I mean? They don't, you know, but he's an outlier. He's there and people give him a hard time because he's intelligent. So, you know, as part of a jock class, there's a lot to be said about pushing down your intelligence in that space.
And I get that. I mean, you know, I remember playing, you know, I grew up playing ice hockey, and so many times teachers and stuff would be, you know, they would make little jokes to me and my friends like, you had another hockey puck to the head, you know, or just something, whatever. But overall, though, would you argue that this, well, let's start on the surface. Would you argue that this is an inspirational ad or not inspirational, or like they're forcing something, or what do you think about the overall implications, like surface level stuff? Let's not get deep yet.
So I think they are threading a needle. I think this kind of marketing is a very precarious place to put your marketing dollars. You know, you have to spend money
right before the NFL season.
Right before the NFL season. That's on purpose. You know, it was splashed on Thursday Night Football. It's going to continue to play. They're going to use different cuts of this. You know, the whole piece is here at 2 minutes, but they're going to use cuts of, you know, 30-second cuts of this all over the place, and they'll make tons of TV spots out of it. But it does thread the needle. It does a very positive spin on something, and it really pushes down the idea of putting Nike as a brand up front in the marketing in the piece. You don't see a lot of it. I think there's a hijab with a Nike swoosh on it that I thought was interesting. But other than a few well-placed swooshes, you don't see a lot of it. There's an ad that's famous in marketing lore, and it's famous in pop culture now too, where Kendall Jenner was in the Pepsi ad and they're going to a protest. And because there was so many Pepsi logos throughout that marketing piece, and it was so ham-handed, and there were cans of Pepsi all over all over while they were filming, it hit as being insincere. And I think in this piece, the sincerity comes through. It's written very tight, you know, tight to the action of, it's very CNCA. The things that they're talking about is literally the things that are happening on your screen. So there's very little room for interpretation. If you see a wrestler with no legs.
I was just thinking of that. You show a young boy with no legs, like doing push-ups and wrestling. I mean,
how can you not be inspired by that?
And if you're insincere, like you said, there was so much Pepsi logo that it came off as insincere.
Yeah.
If you are using a kid with no legs, or the girl in the wheelchair dribbling a basketball, or, you know, these handicapped people, I mean, and you're exploiting them, oh man, like you're done. Like if you do it in such a way that comes off as exploitive or exploitation or whatever.
Yeah.
It's like you're done as a company. And I think that regard, looking at like the kid with no legs and stuff, totally solid. Like you can't pull it off any better than I think what they did to present that kid in an inspirational way without selling your logo.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and you're selling a brand awareness. You're selling an inspirational message. So I think that's amazing.
I think historically Nike's been good at that.
Yeah, and I think they pick good talent to join with, to partner with, from Michael Jordan, you know, through history. I mean, Michael Jordan is like I've said it before on this podcast. He's a marketing brand, and it is due to Nike and his, you know, Air Jordans. They're almost a sub-brand of Nike, but they're so big that they don't even need the swoosh, you know, because they have his silhouette.
Well, and I'm a little disappointed in this ad because they're showing LeBron James claiming the best basketball player ever.
No, he's bigger than basketball.
Ah, come please. He wouldn't be without Jordan.
I agree. So yeah. I definitely agree with you that Jordan is a better basketball player for the era, and compared to LeBron, I think is a better basketball player, but many will disagree with us. But I think what they're selling there is the fact that, hey, you professional athletes make a lot of money. Do something more than, you know, sell shoes.
And he's out promoting schools and...
Yeah.
Right. He's not just selling Hanes t-shirts.
No.
Right.
That's why I own Hanes. I didn't realize that's why I'd have Hanes t-shirt undershirts.
Oh, yeah. There you go.
Subliminal.
Let me ask you this, though. So obviously Kaepernick is a hot button in the world of sports and, you know, I mean, just racial divide and like people who claim he's anti-American or anti-military or, you know, I mean, whatever it is, right? He's like a controversial character in the NFL.
I think it's a lightning rod. He's a lightning rod for controversy. Yeah. In the NFL, and the way that it's positioned is, like you said, patriotic is the positioning from one side, and racial inequality and police brutality is from the other side. So that's that. Not being either of those sides, that's hard to say one way or another.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know. Like, you know, I hate to get political with it, but it is. But placing him in this ad, I think, yes, adds to, like, it's politically charged. Would you agree?
Yeah, or? I think it definitely.
Let me stop you there for a second. What do you think Nike's motivation is having a politically charged individual in an ad saying that whatever you believe in or whatever you're going to try and do, do it to the best of your ability, even if people like criticize you for it? I mean, it's really the message I got from it, right?
Yeah. I mean, I think if you just purely look at the stance, let's say you disagree with Colin Kaepernick, but you look at the stance that he took and the price that he paid for taking that stance. Even if you disagree with him, he did pay the ultimate price. He does not get to play the game that he trained for and played at the highest level through his early life. And at any point in time, he could have bent to the will of the owners.
Well, the jury of public opinion.
Or the jury of public opinion.
Yeah.
He could have easily folded to any of it. And he could have continued playing and making tons of money to play American football. But he chose, you know, at first it seems like maybe childish or it could come off as disingenuous. But the more you lose as you stand up for something, the more credibility you get for making that stand. It's funny to say stand when you're talking about kneeling.
Right. I was thinking that too.
But he did he took a stand against something, and then he paid the ultimate price professionally for taking that stand. And I think if you have this ad and you take him completely out of this ad, then the ad's the same inspirational thing that it has throughout, and you have just a generic VO guy that kind of blends into the background. But you put somebody else famous in there who, like, let's tell you, I'm sorry about Jenner, but you put her in there and she's paid no price for anything. And just the mere fact that she's walking around in a protest made it disingenuous. So I think it adds to the authenticity of the piece, since authenticity is the hot word of the marketing moment in 2018. It is authentic for Colin Kaepernick to be saying these things, whether you agree with him or not. I think it adds to the weight of it. It's the reason people are talking about it. It's the reason that it rings true. It's the reason that it's going to hit millennials in a place where they will believe it, I think.
Again, you know, being politically charged, with Nike making an ad like this that's running during NFL games, the NFL essentially is the organization that like chastises him. And
they blackballed him.
Yeah, they blackballed him. So then they're paying Nike for these ads.
Yes.
So how does this fit in to the NFL's overarching?
No. Nike is paying them to put the ads.
Wait, Nike's paying them. Oh, yeah. I'm sorry. I had that backward. So Nike's paying them. So the NFL is willing to take the money.
Well, there's an intermediary there. So the channels have the deal with the NFL. So Fox, Amazon, CBS.
Oh.
They have the deals. They sponsor for years in advance American football. So they said, here's our slate. We're going to have these games. So Fox had Thursday night. They're splitting that with Amazon this year. I'm very excited since I have Amazon. So because they're the ones taking the money from Nike, it's a little one step removed from the NFL taking a check from Nike for an ad campaign about a person who they have ostracized.
So then Nike's backing Kaepernick. Well, obviously, I kind of get that. But and then Nike's saying, you know what, we're going to throw money at the NFL so they can't say know, and then we're going to throw it in their face.
Yeah, they're paying Fox.
Or they're paying Fox, let's say, right? Okay. And then they're going to throw it in their face to say, like, you know, based on whatever channels we have available to us and the money we have, you know, we're going to rub it in your nose that, like, you guys are asses. Is that kind of what they're doing, or?
I think if Nike was a person, that's what they'd be doing. But because Nike's a company.
Yeah, but didn't it, what, wasn't it ruled that, like, a corporation is just a person?
Yeah. But I don't think Nike doesn't have that vindictiveness in it. It doesn't care about that. It doesn't have, it doesn't need to be concerned about that.
Yeah, but the people who are making decisions, though, put these things in play. I mean, I don't know.
But I think there's a little more nuance to it. I think they understand that it's going to be a lightning rod, and they're kind of grabbing on to the lightning rod to buffer it and to make it a bigger splash than it ever would be alone without it. So they got more bang for the buck. They got $43 million extra dollars in buzz from people talking about it, from podcasts to the news to even all over social media.
Yeah.
Regardless of what you're doing with Nike, you're still promoting their stuff, even if you're destroying your sneakers.
Well, and it's one of those, you know, no, what is it? How is it said? Like, no bad news and no good news or something? No, what is it? What is the cliche?
Yeah.
Now I totally screwed you up. You can't remember. But hey, while you're thinking about that, yeah. I saw you walk into the screen with a bottle with a lot of wax.
Oh, yeah, let's do
you
it.
You might need to, like, dig into that wax. So while you're cutting the top off, you know, whatever, I'm going to open my beer first this week.
Okay, well, I'll talk a little bit about this. This is a whiskey barrel brew.
Oh, my God, why am I not there?
From Indian Wells Brewing Company. And this past week, I had two beers. I had a kombucha pale ale, and I had this amber ale. And I put out on Twitter for this whole week, for 3 days, I had a poll to see which one I was going to drink. And amber ale won, hands down.
Okay. And what was the other one? A kombucha?
It was a KPA.
What the?
Kombucha pale ale.
Kombucha? What the heck is kombucha?
Kombucha is a tea.
Oh, a tea. Oh, hey, watch your face. That knife is going to slip, man.
I know. I was very scared.
Come on. I don't need to call 911 over Skype here. All right. Well, you're digging into the wax.
What do you have tonight?
I have an Elysian Dragon's Tooth Stout. So Elysian Brewery, from what I can figure out, is a small brewery in Seattle. And this was in, like, the local village market here. You know, a little small market I sometimes stop at on the way home from work, you know, on my bicycle before getting the boys. But yeah, so mine's a lot easier, and I see you struggling. But oh, did you get it off?
I gave up on the wax and I just started digging into the top.
Okay, well, hey, I'll get, you know. Okay, let's see how this is. And yours is, you said it's a pale ale?
So the other one is a kombucha pale ale.
Okay.
But this is a whiskey barrel aged amber.
Oh, amber ale. Okay. Wow, whiskey barrel aged. And how big's the bottle there?
It's my 22.
20. Yeah, I have a 22 as well. So, you know, it just has, like, a good creamy head. I don't know if you can see there.
Let me see. Oh, yeah.
Yeah. But like I said, whatever Dragon's Tooth, I don't know, it's something out of, like, Game of Thrones. You might not be interested. All right, so we'll enjoy the beers. Let's take a sip here and we'll give it a quick, like, taste profile, and we get into Thunder Road.
Okay. Are you going to go first or should I? Oh, you're drinking. Okay.
Yeah, go for
it. So this is an amber ale.
I'm not drinking, I'm tasting.
You're tasting.
Yes.
The whiskey barrel comes through. It's very, very strong and single note, I think, with the amber. It is nice, but it is very simple and overpowering.
So which part is overpowering? Powering the barrel aged or, like, the whiskey stuff, or what, which I'm not following you.
I think it blends, like, it hits you right at the top of your palate. It has a bitterness, but not the complex bitterness of a typical Indian IPA.
Like an IPA, yeah.
It has just it's more of a bludgeoning kind of, like, hitting you over the head.
I've never heard of a beer, like, bludgeoning you, but sure. All right, so the Elysian Dragon's Tooth Stout. Uh-huh. I would say on the nose, it's a typical stout. You know, you could smell some grain. grain, fairly mild, not a heavy. I'm not sure what the ABV is. I should look here. It's it's 8.1. So yeah, this'll do me in tonight by the time I'm done with this thing. But yeah, on the nose, it's very mild. It's not heavy. And even tasting, I mean, it's very clean, smooth. You do get some of the smokier grains that you would expect from a stout, but I would say it's straight, kind of down the line. Like, it's not stepping out of the bounds for what you would expect from a typical stout. I mean, you get the smoky grains, you get a little bit of the hint of a bitter, because, you know, stouts are a little bit bitter, but you're not it's well balanced. You're not tasting much of the alcohol, you know, like you might with like a high gravity beer. But I mean, overall, I think it's almost like you taste like some oats or something in there too. I mean, it's a little bit like a lot of tastes of grain, I think is the biggest way to describe.
So the dragon on that, it looks like a very Asian dragon.
It does. You're right. You looked it up, did you?
Yeah.
Yeah. But no, it does. Yeah. I mean, you can see here in the picture. I mean, it's
cool.
Yeah. No, it's a great stout. I mean, it's like an easy drinking stout. You know, best way to describe it is this. You want to introduce somebody who's not into, you know, darker beers and, you know, porter stouts and so on. This, I think, would be a good one because it's not too bitter like some stouts can be.
Mm-hmm.
So, all right.
You've inspired me. I think next week I'm going to get something out of the Dragon's Milk line. I don't know if you had the New Holland stuff that's the Dragon's Milk.
I don't know if I had or not. I'd have to see a bottle of it.
It's another line of stouts, and it's amazing.
Well, sweet then. Maybe I'll look for some next week.
I went to Yard House. Do you have a Yard House up there? No.
No, we don't. We're like small town. We don't have a whole lot of that. Yeah.
Yard House had Dragon's Milk Stout on nitro tap. So it had nitrogen that it was pumping into it. It has like a couple of kegs that it puts on nitrogen
taps.
Yeah.
That's how a lot of stouts work. It's nitro.
Yeah. So the nitro infused tap was great.
Yeah. We have like in this part of in my neck of the woods, we have a lot of like little tap rooms. And the tap rooms like will have a lot of local wine because there's a lot of wineries in the area, and there's a lot of breweries. We have the Solvang Brewery and Firestone Brewery. Like, if you want to get a little bit further away, Stone Brewery and so on. But
no, Figueroa. What about Figueroa?
Oh yeah, Figueroa Mountain. Like, we have all these little breweries around. Well, maybe small to medium sized, and you know, there's so much good beer, and so much of it is just like locally brewed. And I mean, it's like incredible. So we really don't need a place like Yard House.
I don't know. If I'm trying to get my untapped count way up, I'm going to hit Yard House and hit like five different beers.
Yeah, I know. You have to. I know. I have to get some of what am I on now? I'm on like 12. And you're what? Trailer Junkies Ted?
I'm Trailer Junkies Ted.
Yeah, and I'm Trailer Junkies Jim. So you can hit us up on Untapped. See what we're drinking.
Check us out on Untapped. I saw some people that I'm following on Untapped drinking four Locos or something. I was like, why are you logging that?
Well, yeah, like I've seen people with Coors Light and stuff. I mean, but you know what? I will say this. The next time I have like a PBR, like,
oh yeah,
I'm going to log. I don't care what it is I drink. I'm going to log everything because for one, in a year's span, I want to see how many different beers I drink. My concern is like it's going to be coming to like the thousands because every time I go to liquor store, I'm like, I need a new beer. I've had that one. It's on Untapped. All right, I got to get something different. And like, I'll be like 365 days, like four beers a day.
No, it's awesome.
Yeah.
Well, on Labor Day, we went over to the kid's godmother's house and they said they had IPA and Stella. And I was thinking to myself, I can't put, you know, Lagunitas and Stella on Untapped. So I have to go to Ralph's. So I went to Ralph's and I hit up like the Stone 22nd anniversary IPA, double IPA.
Yeah, but what's wrong with Lagunitas, though?
No, Lagunitas is really good, but I was like, I was doing it for Untapped. A little something. No, I wanted to do a higher end, a more exotic beer. And then when I got the anniversary Stone, it wasn't even in Untapped. So I had to enter it like manually. So I thought that was extra special for me.
Yeah. Okay, I got you. So that's because I haven't come across something that wasn't there yet, because even though I think they're obscure, they're still in. So you just add a manual.
Exactly. And you have to agree to terms and conditions of like not messing up the way that they keep their cataloging and stuff.
Gotcha. So when you come to my house next and you have like one of my home brews.
Oh, then we're going to put that in.
You're going to put that in there? Nice. All right. How about Thunder Road, man? We're getting way off the rails.
Let's do Thunder Road.
So Jim Cummings is all over this one. Writer.
He is.
Director. He is. And main actor, right?
Yeah. And producer and auteur and full on everything. Marketing. He's posting this trailer on his own YouTube page. You know, it's releasing through small production companies. So he has more cachet than anyone in the field. You know, he's one of the main actors in Handmaid's Tale. So he has a lot of cachet from that. He won some awards from the short that was Thunder Road in 2016, which we put online here because he has it on his Vimeo page. So you can watch the whole short on our website. 12-minute short that they expanded into a feature film this year. This weekend is the Toronto International Film Festival, the big kickoff of the festival season, the award season, and it is just an amazing piece of work. And when I saw it, I literally wrote back to Jim himself, who was posting it on Twitter, and told him how moving it was to see a piece of art that was a trailer.
All right, two things. You made the comment like off mic or off show about how a trailer like this, and I think you are going to put it onto the website, you were saying.
I have a short article that we'll post in our articles section.
Well, you were saying that like this trailer moved you in such a way that you can't like not review it, right? Or you said it to something like that. And you know, I did some research and stuff, and I kind of came up short in the sense that, you know, whatever his inspiration was, I mean, did he ever go through something like this that you know of, or like where did the story come from?
I don't know. I watched the original. You know, I watched the short from 2016.
Yeah, I saw the short too. Yeah.
It plays out in one master shot, which I thought is just such a raw, powerful way to showcase yourself as an actor. So it comes off as a reel. It comes off as a character piece. It comes off as, you know, just him showing himself as an actor, willing to go places and willing to be vulnerable as an actor and as a filmmaker. So I don't know what inspiration he drew from to get there, but it was an incredibly powerful piece. And I think it reverberates through this, the one scene that plays out in the trailer for the 2018 feature, Thunder Road, is the scene where he's stripping down and giving up his uniform and giving away his gun and everything in his pants and everything. And his coworkers are stripping him down because he's losing it, because he's losing all control of himself in despair and grief. And it plays out all of the dialogue, other than the top and the tail, which is a bookend. And I kind of call that bookend it's a loving nod to the audience. But the guts of it plays out with the audio of him talking to his coworkers. And him talking to his coworkers is just another great showcase of his talent that he showcased as when he eulogized his mother at her funeral. But it plays out with a lot more comedy and a lot more kinetic energy because he's taking off his clothes, he's taking apart his gun, you know, he's doing everything the right way, but he's still losing it, you know? And then it speeds up and it cuts into a place where they're cutting scenes from the rest of this feature into the story, into the pictures that tell the story, while they don't cut away from the dialogue of the one shot. So it has that energy of the short film. That top and tail that they bookend it so nicely with is a game of patty cake with his daughter. At the beginning, he tells his daughter he's not very good at this. And I thought that's such a beautiful thing. When you watch it a couple times, you can take it as Jim as the filmmaker telling you as the audience that he's not very comfortable with making a feature film. And he's even less comfortable with making a trailer for a feature film. But he thinks he knows a little bit about pacing and a little bit about comedic timing and a little bit about all these things. And all of that timing and pacing, and, you know, it's a nice way to say, I'm going to play patty cake with you, the audience. And it's a virtual game of patty cake that he plays with the audience. But he sells himself short. He says, I'm not very good at this. And then at the end, when we get back to him playing patty cake, he's demolishing it. He knows exactly what he's doing. He was totally messing with his daughter. He plays an awesome round of patty cake with her. And she is like the pinnacle of impressed, you know? And I thought, what a beautiful way to leave the audience, is like, if the audience is half as impressed as his daughter is at his game of patty cake with his filmmaking, then they can be sure to go see a movie and be entertained if they were entertained with that 90 seconds in the middle.
Yeah, I mean, I think it was like the best eulogy ever. A couple things about it that I'm not really familiar with, because, you know, in 2016, the short came out and I didn't watch it until today when you shared it with me. So his mother's the one who passed away. He said his wife left him, I'm assuming through a divorce. And when he said he lost his kid, it seems like because he loses like his mind with the police and all this kind of stuff, where, like you said, the police are stripping him down, he lost his kid to what, like child welfare services?
That's my thought too. And I know if you look at the picture that is placed upon the casket in the short film, it's a picture of the mother with granddaughter. So his mother and his daughter in the picture.
Yeah.
But in the trailer, it's just a picture of his mother. And I hope that that's a way to kind of assuage the audience from thinking that he lost both his mother and his daughter, because I know that was a point of confusion. And like you said, you watched this earlier today. I watched it with Anne earlier as well. And Anne too was confused when he says that in the heat of the moment. Makes you feel like maybe she's dead too.
Right. Yeah.
And maybe he lost both of them. Maybe there's another tragic instance where, you know, where he loses his daughter as well. But I definitely think it's child services. I don't think it is like literally losing his daughter.
And the thing that I really enjoyed about the trailer was, so as the cameraman is zooming on him, he's zooming in such a way that he maintains the headspace. And this is just like a photography aesthetic thing, but he maintains the headspace as it's like the, what is it, 1x235, you know?
Yeah, 235, yeah.
Yeah. So it's that, you know, it's super wide and he's in the center, but as they're zooming, they're maintaining the aspect ratio, they're maintaining the headspace, but they're kind of coming up from below. And in doing so, they're maintaining all of the things that the eye is drawn to while bringing in closer. And in doing so, they capture the dude to the left who's recording on an iPhone. And that's also like perfectly framed within the frame and everything. So the cinematography of that short, whoever the cameraman was, but I think did an awesome job in maintaining the audience
perspective. Yeah.
Yeah. The perspective and the audience within the frame to say like they never lose you, because as it's zooming in, it's not changing anything and it's like subtle. You don't notice it really that quickly. I guess unless you're looking for it.
No, I think it's a known effect. So there's the Spielberg shot, the Hitchcock shot, where they do a quick push and a zoom in the opposite direction. So it completely rips the audience out of the moment, and it completely takes you out of the time and space that you're in, and it basically knocks you off of your feet.
So wait, they push a zoom and pull focus? Wait. I missed that.
Okay, so there's a shot in Jaws where they're pushing in to Roy Schneider, and they pull the zoom out at the same time. So it looks like Roy on the beach is staying in the same place, but everything around him is becoming distorted.
So they move the camera in as they're zooming out. out?
Either, I forget which way it is.
Yeah.
Okay. My film school is rusty, but it's a Hitchcock invented shot where I think it's from Vertigo, where you...
Oh, yeah, good one.
I think both of those are both considered Hitchcock and Spielberg shots. If you push in and zoom out or pull out and zoom in, if you're trying to keep the main actor in the center while distorting all of the stuff on the periphery, that is the intent of the Hitchcock shot. It is to unmoor the audience from reality. But I think you're talking about doing the exact opposite, where you're trying to zoom in but not lose any of the periphery. So you have to zoom and push in a balanced way so that everything's staying in perspective for the aspect ratio that you're dealing with.
Yeah, I got you. So essentially it's the Vertigo effect, and they call it the Hitchcock pull.
There you go.
Yeah, so it's like as the background is changing, the person is maintaining their perspective.
The object in the center of the frame
stays where it is.
Appears to stay in the same position, but with a mixture of a dolly pull and a zoom in, the effect is that everything around him becomes distorted.
Yeah. So how about, I'm going to put this in the show notes. I found an awesome, like, it's like 5 minutes, and it shows the Roy Scheider's shot. It shows the Vertigo shot. And it has like all of them.
Okay, good.
So yeah, we'll put that in the show notes because I think it's an important aspect of that really shows what we're talking about here, or what Ted's talking.
And thank God for my 14-year-old film school knowledge, but it is interesting to know that like Jim Cummings and his team, because obviously he has a team that he's working with, and even though he was the on screen the whole time, I'm sure he played a major part in figuring out the cinematography of that short. So I think it's interesting to know that like you have something that is as deeply seated as the Vertigo shot, as this Hitchcock Spielberg shot. And yet it is the knowledge of something like that that allows you to break the rules of doing that and to do the exact opposite for the exact opposite effect. You know, you feel like you're very safe. You're in a safe place with Jim, and Jim is just laying there raw to the loss of a parent, you know?
I mean, I totally know. I mean, it's Thunder Road, for crying out loud. Yeah, the dance, man, but... Are you going to see this? Or I mean, it's so okay. Let's back up a little bit. So it's not a matter of are you going to see this? And because I was going to say, yeah, it's going to be streaming and blah, 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 or same old like shtick. Right. But it looks like it's only streaming in the iTunes store.
Yes. Yeah, so it is iTunes. It seems like iTunes is the one who helped produce it, helped foot the bill, and helped distribute it. So similar to what we were saying about last week, where Facebook is having their, sorry for your loss, and they're having Facebook Watch. This is something that feels like it's an exclusive to iTunes and an iTunes download. And because it's going in the festival circuit, it's going to have to be limited release on some screen somewhere.
Yeah, because it's like a year of festivals. It's not, it looks like it's not released to theater, right?
Not a wide release, yes.
Yeah.
And it's really amazing because when you think of Jim Cummings' career, he's very well admired for Handmaid's Tale. But Handmaid's Tale is an award-winning series on another streaming platform. It's on Hulu. So it's completely native to say, like, let's take a streaming star, because that's what he is, and he's a streaming social star, and put him in another streaming platform and give him the latitude to do what he wants, but yet keep it alive in the festival circuit by putting it out in a handful of theaters so it gets enough out there to be acknowledged as a possibility for eligible for awards.
Now, you know, you look at the Academy Awards and, you know, the bigger platform awards, something like a Thunder Road, is there, and it's my ignorance really, but is there a category for an independent film like this? I mean, I don't even know.
It's so funny you bring that up. So this week, the Oscars have pushed back their plans for the popularity award.
Yeah, we talked about that a few weeks ago, and we were like, well, how do you define popular? I mean, and it's true. I mean, really, how do you define it?
Yeah, so they don't know, and they don't understand what's going on. So
they don't know.
I think this is part of what is showing the fact that they are really reeling from not understanding how the industry and how media is changing. So as you watch things on streaming services and not in theaters, and you have fights between, you know, Cannes Film Festival and Netflix because of the Netflix European deals.
Ted, let me stop you for a second.
Yeah.
Who doesn't know? Is it that like the film industry as a whole doesn't understand, or the Academy doesn't understand, or the old guard of the traditional media? Who doesn't understand there's a paradigm shift?
Yeah, so there's a lot of things at play. I think the Oscars have a cachet. They have like what we were talking about last week or the week before, where they have a pedigree and they have an award to give. And the more you dilute that award, the less that award means.
Yeah.
And then the industry, the theatrical industry, uses that awards in marketing in future films. So as you see actors, they use the branding of Academy Award nominee, Academy Award winner as part of their name in the next feature that they're in. So it really travels along with the actors and the directors and the filmmakers as they make future movies in their career. But that showcase has a one-time airing, a Super Bowl of its own, where it does its own show, and the ratings for that show year after year get eroded. So as the ratings for the Oscars erode, they're constantly trying to figure out how to stop the erosion and bring people back. So I think that is the place where they're missing the most.
Yeah, I mean, one way to do that is to make it less than 4 hours.
Yes, but when you do that, then you alienate the craftsmen that are normally honored by their technical craftsmanship, you know, such as whatever cinematographers and sound designers and all the people that they were going to shove into a pre-television event.
No, I get it. The trailer junkie sound engineer. I totally know what you mean, you know. The guy who works hard at making this thing sound bad. I try. But no, you know, I get it though. I mean, it's one of those things where you take an independent film that is probably this guy's like life and blood poured into it, and he's like self-promoting on Twitter and his marketing, and he's probably like, no exaggeration, he's probably at least 25% of his marketing team, you know. He's his own marketing guy, you know, and he's bootstrapping this thing. And I mean, you know, hey, I wish him luck. I mean, who knows? Like, I mean, it's got to wind up on Netflix at some point. I mean, everything seems to. And right now it's what, strictly iTunes?
Yeah, I think you say it's got to, but it would seem like Apple would be a pretty harsh competitor. I don't think I see anything on Amazon and expect to see it ever on Netflix. So I would put this in the same category. I would put things in Amazon, things on Apple, and things on Netflix. I would see them, if they're produced by those three companies, I would not expect to ever see them on the other platform.
So Netflix is in most households. Amazon is probably in most households. iTunes might be in 50% of households if you look at like Android versus iPhone kind of a thing. So you don't think they're ever going to like cross-platform it? I mean, I I'm not even saying like iTunes, but like, you know, Man in the High Castle, you don't ever see crossing over onto Netflix.
Right.
Wow. Okay.
Yeah.
I mean, I think I agree with you, but
I think Handmaid's Tale and Man in High Castle and Stranger Things, just to name like the top of mind pieces for each of those streaming devices. Orange is New Black.
Yeah.
You know, I think those things wouldn't cross over because they're such, I mean, you talk about the pitch man for Verizon going to Sprint, you know, still to this day, when I hear Sprint radio ads with that guy on it, I still think they're Verizon ads. I don't.
Well, and the guy on the Sprint ad acknowledges he was on the Verizon ad.
Yeah.
You know, but, you know, and that makes sense, too, though. I mean, if you think about it, like Big Bang Theory is what, CBS. So if it's not like all of a sudden Big Bang Theory is going to wind up like being aired on, you know, ABC, you know, it's a CBS show.
Okay. Yeah. I think so we call it a CBS show, but it's a Warner Brothers show. It's produced by Warner Brothers, so it would sell to whomever would pay the bills to keep the lights on. But it is a CBS show as far as distribution goes.
As far as distribution. But you have like Seinfeld. Okay, ABC. I don't know. What was that? A Paramount, I guess?
Which one? Seinfeld?
Seinfeld.
Oh, I don't know who produced it. It was NBC.
NBC. That's what it was.
NBC,
yeah.
Distributed it. I want to say it was Warner Brothers too.
But in syndication, it's like on what? Like, you know, the WB, WGN. It lands on all these different networks and that have nothing to do with the original airing of the show. They just bought it in syndication and are rerunning it. And then even with that, yes, too, you can even look at like Nick at Night, right? Or Nickelodeon or whatever, you know.
Right. And Hulu now. Hulu owns all the episodes.
Yeah.
They've bought all the seasons and they have everything.
So they do land on other networks.
That is an old school mentality, because things that are produced by production companies were distributed to other distribution companies.
Yeah, I gotcha. Wow, that gets deep in the reeds, you know?
Like you were talking about Seinfeld as a NBC show.
Right.
But it's produced by Columbia, TriStar Television, and Sony Pictures Television. So the fact that there's a separate company that was producing it allows you to say when it goes into quote unquote syndication, that those are the production companies are the companies that are making those dollars. NBC doesn't have that anymore. So I think there's become, with Netflix producing their own content, there's a lot more of a and the distribution of their content is no longer linear in its distribution. Like if CBS wanted to produce, you know, CBS has the Radford lot, and they produced a lot of television on this one lot here in Los Angeles. But they produced so much television that they didn't have enough time on their air in prime time to air all the shows. So they produced more shows than they could air, and they had to sell it to other networks. With a nonlinear distribution with streaming, you could produce infinite content and allow it to be browsed by an individual.
Yeah, there's no time slots.
You would never have to sell it to another distribution hub to get it, to allow it to be seen. So that's the X factor that we're no longer in.
Yeah. So in other words, you would have CBS, NBC, well, let's say NBC with Seinfeld we were talking about, and NBC would be the distribution house, and Sony and whatever you said, the
TriStar
TV,
Columbia TriStar TV.
Yeah. So they would be like the producers who essentially like fronted the money and paid for it and all this stuff.
Exactly.
NBC was the one who distributed it to the public across the country, and then right. And there's only so many like 7 p.m. slots on a Thursday, meaning there's one. And that's when Seinfeld lands.
Right.
Whereas if you look at, so to continue with that, so then CBS or NBC or whatever produces or wants to distribute or fronts money for so many shows, they're going to look at the number of time slots and they're going to say each time slot is valued at a certain price. So it's a commodity.
Right.
And then they're going to say pretty much the time slots are filled. You can't enter.
Right.
Whereas an Amazon, a Hulu, a Netflix, because it's internet based and storage is cheap and there's like an infinite amount of storage, essentially, you know, they could produce the number of shows they want to produce. And then that just is what's in their inventory.
It's always available forever.
So one way to think about this is, and I don't remember the show that like set it off, but it was on Netflix, and it might have been House of Cards, but I could be a little bit wrong on this. I'm a little bit foggy. But Netflix came out with a show or a series of shows. There was like a handful, like 2-3 shows. And we were like, oh, wow, Netflix has a new show. How novel. And we would watch the show, and it's like, wow, that was a really good show. And am I, you know what? I think it was House of Cards. And it was like, wow, that was like a produced show with, you know, I mean, all of the scandalous side, but Kevin Spacey, who was like a top billed actor, and it was amazing to see this top billed actor and all this, all, you know, just the quality of the production. And then they would add another show and another show, and you're like, at some point you're like, I just can't keep up with all these shows they have.
Right.
It's just too much.
It's not built to serve an individual. It's built to serve all the individuals. You know what I mean? So the fact that we cannot keep up with everything on Netflix is by design. You know, it is designed to serve you, to serve your kids, to serve your parents, to serve everyone.
It's essentially 500 channels of cable in one service. Like everybody, you show up and you find what you want.
Right. And I think what we were talking about last week with Amazon, as far as Amazon selling that smile into their branding and trying to be happy all the time, I think Netflix has done something where I call it a clear box branding, where you see the Netflix logo and you don't feel a specific feeling, or everybody who sees the Netflix logo can imbue their own feeling towards it, whatever that is. So it really is kind of a masterful ploy in the marketing space.
I guess my last comment with it is, when I was growing up, NBC had a certain flavor of shows. ABC had its own flavor that was kind of like NBC, but then CBS was completely like different. Like, you know, looking back on it as like a more learned adult, they had like a cerebral, contextual, I don't know, like Murphy Brown, I guess, was on CBS, if I had to guess. And, you know, it was like political, and they talked about topics that you had to be in the know, rather than that like surface level content that maybe NBC was more a part of. Mm-hmm. And I think I might have been a little bit too young at the time to really appreciate the CBS shows.
Yeah, it's so, well, you brought up Murphy Brown.
I'm looking forward to coming back.
I was driving in Burbank, and I saw a billboard on, I saw a bus enclosure out of home poster for Murphy Brown. And it has all the characters in Murphy Brown leaning, you know, and they're all leaning in one direction. And you think, oh, that's funny, because as I'm looking at them, they're leaning to the left, you know, because they're left leaning, obviously, in their, political standings. But then I thought to myself, but if you're taking it from their perspective, they're actually leaning to their right. So what does that mean? Like, why is it so, shouldn't it be from, they should be leaning to the other side?
Because of the mirrored effect, right? Isn't that what you mean?
What's that?
The mirror effect.
No, because mirror effect. Right,
yeah,
correct.
Yeah, yeah.
So from their point of view, they're actually leaning to the right.
Exactly.
And from my point of view, they're leaning to the left. So it should be stage, you know. I thought they should be leaning the other way. It should be from their perspective. But then I thought,
you get it. The 99.99 and definite 9% is like, oh no, I get that. But you're the one who's like, no, they got to be leaning to the left to be to right, to the left. Dude, I'm even lost.
Anyway, that wasn't on the slate for this evening, but I thought you brought up Murphy Brown, so it was kind
how
of
much of that? Wait, how much of tonight was on the slate for the, we had like one thing on the slate. We're just in a million directions. So you know what we need? You know what we need? What do you think we need? Come on.
We need a break.
Boom.
Coming up on Trailer Junkies Podcast.
But if you're looking for gifts of Mads eating food in a very naughty way, like everything that he eats is delicious and juicy, and you know, it's all from Hannibal, and it's just an amazing show, and everybody should check it out.
If you enjoy our trailer reviews, or even if you hate them, let us know. We love feedback. We're on Twitter at @TJunkiesPodcast and Instagram at @TrailerJunkiesPodcast. You can also comment on the episodes at TrailerJunkiesPodcast.com. Our email is info@TrailerJunkiesPodcast.com. And you could also leave us a review in iTunes or wherever you get your podcasts. Now let's get back to it.
All right, Ted, we got back from our break and we're at Eternity's Gate.
Oh, it's a wonderful place to be.
It seems like it's going to go on forever. So what's your opinion?
This movie looks amazing to me. It's why we had to fit it in this week. Willem Dafoe, the voiceover throughout this is, it seems spot on. Again, last week we talked about the fact that Kevin Costner didn't do an accent when he played Robin Hood.
Right.
I think Willem is doing the same thing where he is just playing straight Willem in the voice, but his look is amazing.
See, I don't have a problem with that, though. I think from the way the trailer plays out, yeah, it's an American movie, American-produced movie, from what I could tell.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a Vincent Van Gogh story that's made in Hollywood. I don't have an issue with it.
Right. And I think it's also like last week when we talk about, you know, in like Flynn, another Hollywood portrayal of a Hollywood actor. You know, this is a Hollywood portrayal of a world-class artist, you know? So...
Yeah, Dutch artist.
I agree with you. Yeah, I agree with you wholeheartedly.
Ted, I'm a little bit nervous venturing into uncharted waters, into, you know, art world and everything without Anne. Yeah. You know, we almost need her for this, but we'll do our best. You know, I mean, she is by far our art historian or art like lecturer. But hey, you know, I mean, I've been to Amsterdam. So Clarissa and I go to Amsterdam and we go to, you know.
Recently.
Yeah, it was a few years ago.
Okay.
But we were, you know, we went to a bunch of museums and things, you know, the Rijksmuseum and all this stuff. And so we're in line for the Van Gogh Museum. And, you know, we're watching the little like marquee going on and they keep showing like different pictures because it's like all digital. And we wait in line for like, you know, 40 minutes. And finally we're just like, you know, we're not into Van Gogh. Like, I don't know why, but both of us were just not into Van Gogh. So
right. We're
like, you know what, let's just go and do something else. And I think we rented bikes and like went to some park and like watched birds land. You know, I don't know what it was, but, but, you know, in a way, looking at this movie, I wish we went to the museum so I had just a little bit more knowledge than I think the Rijksmuseum gave me. But at the same time, it's like I'm still not really into Van Gogh, but maybe this movie's gonna change my mind. I didn't know he was crazy. You know, that might help.
You knew he cut his own ear off, right?
Well, I did know that, yeah. Yeah.
Yeah, so I agree with you. So I
okay.
Too.
Wait, let me back up. So
yeah,
okay, maybe I didn't phrase that properly. Like I knew he was a little bit off his nut because who cuts his ear off? But like I didn't realize the way the trailer shows it is almost like a psychosis.
Yes, and I think what the trailer is trying to encapsulate is it's a directional psychosis.
Yeah.
So it's like when he realizes that he is crazy, or for lack of a better word, you know, crazy, he basically puts it off in a direction and sets off to utilize the energy that this causes, you know, this energy that this wells up inside of him and pushes him to the edge. You know, the few lines that really turned me on to this is the idea of maybe I'm an artist for people who haven't been born yet.
Yeah.
And how true a statement that was, and how revered and how loved he is after the fact, and how tortured he is in his life, and the fact that he's tortured, it basically plays into the art. We've talked about Caravaggio, you know, and Anton Fuqua, and the idea of the tragedy and the tortured souls that are Renaissance from many years in the past, and how people have to channel that energy. And I think that's this great idea of forget about now, because, you know, he's like, you know, as far as what this world has to offer me, I'm beyond saving, but maybe I can do something that can live on forever after me, you know? And I thought that was that's a beautiful way to kind of think about some things that are outside of your control.
What do you know about the name Willem?
Oh, I don't know anything about Willem.
Okay, so, you know, Willem Dafoe is the actor, and Vincent Van Gogh's middle name is Willem.
Oh.
So Vincent Willem Van Gogh and Willem Dafoe. I don't know two Willems like my whole life other than Willem Dafoe. And he's playing a guy whose middle name is Willem. What are the odds?
That's funny. And not to mention the supporting cast. Anne's a big fan of Rupert Friend. I'm a big fan of Oscar Isaac as Paul Gauguin. And then...
I heard you're a big fan of Mads.
So Mads Mikkelsen.
Yeah.
I am beyond a big fan of Mads. The official Mads, as he's known in the Twitter sphere. I finished up, the short aside is I finished up Jack Ryan. Loved the series. Did you start it?
Yeah, we have two episodes left. It's eight episodes.
You did six.
We did six, yeah.
How do you feel?
You know, so I've been trying to like assess my feelings about the show after each episode, right?
Okay.
Because I wanted to talk to you about whatever, but...
Let's save it for next week because the last two episodes are very, you know, I think it ties it all up very, very nicely. But okay, so I finished Jack Ryan and then I immediately needed something else to jump into. And I had another season left of Hannibal. And if you haven't seen Hannibal, the TV show, it started on NBC and then it was a streaming, but Mads plays Hannibal Lecter against Hugh Dacey, who plays the autistic FBI agent.
Wait, the Hannibal Lecter as in the Silence of the Lambs?
Yes.
Whoa, okay. Maybe I should watch this.
Yeah, so, and it's directed by, well, it's written and produced since it's originally a TV show, the writers, so directors rule filmmaking and writers rule television.
And is Clarice in the show?
So there is in the first season, there is a Clarice-like character.
Okay.
But it's really Hugh Dacey. Hugh Darcy. I'm saying his name wrong. But an actor from Downton Abbey. I think I could be getting that all wrong because I've never seen it. But he's a very highly acclaimed British actor. He plays against him in kind of the cat mouse of all of Hannibal Lecter's foils. And then Lawrence Fishburne plays the head FBI agent, kind of that's, what's his name? Scott Glenn.
Oh, Scott Glenn, yeah.
Scott Glenn. The Scott Glenn character is played by Lawrence Fishburne, which is just an amazing tour de force performance as well. So the three of them kind of play in this cat and mouse cop robber kind of space. And just when you put stuff in Brian Fuller's hands, it becomes art on a palette of the screen. You know, when you talk about Van Gogh and you talk about the fact that he's painting, Brian Fuller's art direction or the things that he puts together, he did the TV show, the short-lived TV show called Pushing Daisies. And every week they had a pie maker solving a crime about a person that died that week. But the colors and the vibrancy of the palette of what was going on in that television show was phenomenal. And the table settings of Hannibal in the TV show are pieces of art that could easily be painted by Caravaggio.
And how awesome is it to have a name like Mads?
It's amazing.
This cannibal you have him getting to know, I think I can help Goodwill see his face.
But if you're looking for gifs of Mads eating food in a very naughty way, like everything that he eats is delicious and juicy, and you know it's all from Hannibal, and it's just an amazing show, and everybody should check it out.
Yeah, I might, because I did enjoy Silence of the Lambs, and whenever people ask Larissa how to pronounce her name for some reason or another, she always says something about like Clarice.
A census taker once tried to test me. I ate his liver with some fava beans and a nice Chianti.
So, I don't know, but like, it's not that that happens often, but it happens often enough.
That's awesome.
In a weird sort of a way, but yeah, no, I mean, it seems like a really cool movie about an artist who was dealing with his own, you know, like mental illness, whatever you might call it. But I think a lot of like, when you think about artists and people, you know, Edgar Allan Poe comes to mind, apparently in this one, you know, you have Vincent Van Django, and there's, I mean, even Jim Morrison was kind of mad in his own right and so on as a musician. And when you have these people who are extremely talented, you know, it really strikes me in the sense that they're just crazy, I guess. Maybe that's why you are talented in those areas.
Yeah. This really, you know, I think they missed a little bit of a legacy sell. They talk about Julian Schnabel. Now I'm going to butcher his name. But he did, what is the big movie? The Diving Bell and the Butterfly. That was his big, huge success of 2007. And they mentioned it two times in this trailer.
Yeah.
But I don't think they mentioned once. Did you see any mention of Basquiat?
No.
So he also, one of his directorial debut was the film Basquiat, which was early. It was the 90s. And
I would know nothing of that.
And it too is the same thing where it's, you know, it's a little more raw, a little less of the artistic flair of what is basically the Van Gogh movie that we're reviewing.
Right.
But it is Basquiat, so it is kinetic. It has an energy to it that matches the artist. So this, to be able to stretch from New York underground of Basquiat to all the way reaching back to the Dutch Renaissance, would you say, of Vincent van Gogh, is just an amazing counterpoint to say, like, rather than mentioning the Diving Bell and the Butterfly twice, why not throw in a bone about Basquiat too, I would say.
Well, and Van Gogh, I think, is more contemporary. I mean, the Dutch Renaissance was probably what, like, you know.
Oh, that's more Rembrandt.
Rembrandt, like, yeah, 1400s. Yeah, 1500s, something like that. You know, when they were more in the sailing, I don't know, like, let's go to
the more depressing, dark oils.
Yeah, the Dutch West Indies, and we're going to go, like, gain treasure, you know, kind of a stuff. Where Van Gogh was probably more 1870s, maybe, something of that nature, or those years. But, yeah, you know, I think overall, you know, I don't know if I'm going to watch it. I might watch it, you know, like, again, like we always talk about streaming, but I might watch it there, and I think it will give me a new perspective and a new appreciation, or maybe an overall appreciation for Van Gogh, because I don't know why, but I've just never been into his art, you know, like, I like so many other things before his. Maybe they're just too colorful or something, I don't know, but yeah. Anyway, Ted, what do you think? Are you going to see this?
I want to see it, but again, we're talking about the limited resources and the limited time available. I think The Favorite is coming out soon, maybe next month. I think that's the next movie that I'm going to see in the theater. A new trailer came out. We've already covered it.
And totally wants to see it.
But the last trailer from it is amazing. And it really, it sets up the interplay between the competition for the Queen's approval in just a beautiful way. So that's the movie I'm pushing for. We're very happy to celebrate Barbara's birthday with her a couple days this week.
Yeah.
So we brought a cake over there, and I was hinting at the fact that we might be dropping the kids off for so we could go see The Favorite.
All right, so you may not see this in the theater. Well, it sounds like you won't see it in the theater, but you might see it streaming.
Yes.
I would say that this is probably one of those movies. I'll be hard pressed to see. I mean, it's one of those ones I think, like, all well intentioned, I'd like to, but I probably won't.
Maybe you'll rent scooters or something and
rent scooters. Yeah, no, this is, you know, whatever. But no, I think Willem Dafoe's going to play an awesome Van Gogh.
Yeah.
You know, but we'll see. All right, man, what do you say we get out of here? We went on and on about, like, a lot of stuff. Like,
we covered a lot.
I would say we covered a little, but in a wide breadth of discussion.
Yes.
Yeah, few topics, wide discussion.
Deep discussion.
Deep dives.
All right, Jimmy.
All right, man. Well, hey, you have a good night.
See you next week.
All right. Bye now.
Bye.
Next week, join Jim and Ted as they disarm another Hollywood bomb or marketing masterpiece. Remember, the Holy Trinity of podcasting. Subscribe, like, share.
Special thanks to Jeremy Kent Jackson for the voiceover and Rahelio for the music.